Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science. And today, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and politics. Our lead story today concerns the ups and downs in the North Korean-U.S. peace negotiations. First, they were canceled. President Donald Trump said, nope, we're not going to meet with the North Koreans. But then there was a lot of backdoor maneuvering between the two sides, and, we're right back on track again. Let's hope that we have a successful conclusion of the summit talks, historic talks between North Korea and the United States to denuclearize the entire Korean Peninsula. But let's not be naive about it. Let's look at the pros and cons and also who's in a better bargaining position, the North Koreans or the United States, when they execute this dance as they begin to negotiate a potential historic agreement between North and South. Also, space tourism is in the news. Richard Branson, the billionaire founder of Virgin Atlantic and Virgin Galactic, is saying that they had a successful test of its Spaceship Two Unity rocket that blasted off and went 114,000 feet right near the boundary between the Earth and outer space. Well, if you have a spare $250,000, then perhaps you too can join the celebrities that have signed up to go into space with Spaceship Two. But the question is, why should we do it? What are we going to gain? And of course, is it just a plaything for the rich and famous, or is there some real science involved there? And speaking about space planes, the Russians in March unveiled the fact that they have a new weapon that could, perhaps change the balance between the United States and Russia. And Putin, back in March, said that, yes, it's a weapon that can evade any kind of Star Wars defense shield around the United States. It's called the hypersonic glide vehicle. That's a mouthful. However, is it a game changer? Will it alter the balance between the United States and Russia when we have a device that can reach Mach 10 to Mach 20? Is this a new era in the arms race? Well, we'll talk about that when we talk not about ICBMs, but about hypersonic glide vehicles. And then on the medical front, the United States is now urging its citizens to begin the process of testing yourself for colon cancer, not at age 50, but at age 45. Many epidemiologists and health scientists are alarmed at the fact that there's an increase in colon cancer among young people, and therefore, the recommendation is to start having a colonoscopy or other kinds of tests starting at the age of 45. And so then the question is, what are the pros and cons concerning colon cancer, which is the second leading cancer in the United States? And speaking about the medical front, we'll also summarize some of the results in brain science. It turns out a new theory is being proposed that sheds light, we think, on autism and brain development. It turns out that scientists in the United Kingdom at King's College have identified not one but two major types of brain cells, go and no-go cells, which in turn may affect the balance of the brain. And the theory is that in autism, the balance between these two kinds of cells is thrown a kilter, and that may be responsible for autism. Well, we'll see. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today concerns the ups and downs of the negotiation between North Korea and the United States. Well, the first question is this rather unusual? Well, yes and no. You see, whenever the two superpowers get together to talk about things, or whenever great nations begin to size up the world situation, there's a lot of plus and minus that goes back and forth. However, most of it done quietly and diplomatically behind closed doors. Well, President Donald Trump is a businessman, not a diplomat, and a lot of the negotiations are right in the open. And the question is, are the talks going to take place? Well, we don't know. First, they were canceled. But now a dance has emerged between North Korea and the United States, and both powers realize that it's in their interest to keep the talks going. So now it's getting serious. Top diplomats from North Korea have now visited the United States, something that is unprecedented in the history of negotiations between North Korea and the United States. Journalists were invited into North Korea for a historic event, and that is the detonation of a major nuclear test site in North Korea. North Korea allowed these journalists to photograph the dynamiting of one of the major nuclear test sites. And so this is now serious. We're not talking about simply dickering over the shape of the table. We're talking about real concrete proposals being placed that could lead, perhaps, to denuclearization. Well, first of all, a lot of questions have to be raised. First of all, who's in a better bargaining position? Who's the one making the most concessions at the present time? And what's at stake? And what could go wrong? Well, first of all, if you take a look at it strictly from a bargaining position, it turns out that the United States is probably in a better position than North Korea. First of all, there are indications that the sanctions are hurting. That is, because the squeeze is being placed on North Korea in ways that were not done historically, it means that the North Korean economy is suffering, putting pressure on North Korea, which then has to rely more on China for 90% of its goods that come into that country. And so the United States is at a slight advantage there when it comes to bargaining over sanctions. Also, there are unconfirmed reports that the nuclear test site used by the North Koreans has collapsed. That's right. The last test was a test of a hydrogen bomb-like weapon, and it apparently was so great that it caused the mountain in which the tests are conducted to collapse. And of course, it takes a lot of effort to create a new nuclear test site, and you have to test nuclear weapons to make sure that they work in an actual war. So in that situation, the North Koreans are at a disadvantage there, but they're trying to salvage it by allowing journalists to come in to witness the detonation of the nuclear test sites as if it was simply out of the blue. Actually, it was basically a statement that the North Koreans have not been able to safely test its own nuclear weapons inside a mountaintop. And third, the North Koreans are at a slight disadvantage because they have not yet demonstrated the ability to reliably strike the United States with an ICBM. The fact that they could hit the United States with a nuclear weapon, that is off the table. We know that it's possible because they have tested an ICBM, which in principle, if aimed toward the United States, would actually hit the U.S. of A. However, how reliable is that test? That's the key word, reliability. First of all, the North Koreans have not demonstrated that their warheads can be aimed at the United States in a proper way to hit a city. And second of all, they have not demonstrated that the nuclear weapon will survive the reentry. In fact, there are indications that the last test of a weapon by the North Koreans disintegrated just before impact, making it rather useless. So again, we don't know how accurate these North Korean missiles are. And second of all, we don't know the integrity of these missiles as they re-enter the atmosphere at hypersonic velocities. So in that sense, I think the United States has a slight advantage over North Korea when it comes to entering these talks. And then, what are the best case and worst case scenarios? Well, the worst case scenario is that the North Koreans once again play us for fools. Time and again, the North Koreans have said that yes, they will begin the process of scaling back their nuclear arsenal, and basically they cheated. For example, the North Koreans have not one but at least two nuclear sites to enrich nuclear fuel. One at Yongbyon to enrich plutonium, and another secret one that enriches uranium. Well, that second uranium enrichment site was not on the table when the North Koreans engaged in talks with the United States. In other words, they cheated. So, in other words, there could be yet another cycle, a cycle in which the North Koreans seem to want to denuclearize, Then they benefit from it because of increased trade from the West and a reduction of sanctions, and then they cheat. And then we start all over again in the next cycle. And so in the worst-case scenario, they cheat because, well, quite frankly, it's difficult to supervise a complete denuclearization of another country. However, let's be honest, there's also a best-case scenario as well. And a best-case scenario is, well, we saw what happened to China and the Soviet Union. In the case of the Soviet Union, well, they spent so much money on nuclear weapons that it helped to disintegrate their economy, leading to the breakup of the Soviet Union. And in the case of China, they adopted a form of state capitalism. So, in other words, in a best-case scenario, maybe the government of North Korea will open up and join the family of nations so that their people don't have to starve to death in order to preserve the prestige and honor of their elite. So let's hope for the best-case scenario. Let's hope that some kind of agreement can be made to denuclearize all of North and South Korea and begin the process of opening up North Korea to join the family of nations. Well, let's hold our breath because, as I said, in the worst-case scenario, perhaps we're being played for fools and the whole cycle will start once again. Also, news from outer space. Richard Branson, the billionaire behind Virgin Atlantic, has been sponsoring Spaceship Two, and that is a rocket plane that goes right to the border between the Earth and outer space, which is about 70 miles up from the surface of the planet Earth. He wants to make space tourism part and parcel of ordinary living. Now, if you have a spare $250,000, you too can join the long line of celebrities that have decided that they want to be up there with the space program. They want to see the Earth looking down from outer space. However, there are snags. One snag is the fact that just a few years ago, there was a fatal accident. A fatal accident involving Spaceship Two. And analysis of the accident have shown that it was, in fact, human error. And it shows you that, well, space travel is not necessarily as safe as you think it is. On average, 1% of the time, we have a major catastrophic failure in our rockets. 1% of the time. And remember, we're over 50 years into the space age. And still, we have not been able to bring down that number down from 1%. And why is that? First of all, there are a lot of moving parts. A rocket is just not one block of rocket fuel. No, there are thousands of pieces of instruments, and one slight mistake, one slight miscalibration, one slight leakage, one slight break can cause the entire mission to fail. And so there are a lot of moving parts involved, and that's one reason why we have not been able to bring down the incidence of catastrophic failure less than 1%. So sometimes people ask me, do I want to go into outer space? And I say to them, well, no thank you. I'll let somebody else get all the glory by being the first tourist to go into outer space. However, we should also point out that there are pros and cons to space tourism. Some of the critics of space tourism simply say, is this nothing but a plaything for rich billionaires who have nothing else to do except to brag about how the fact that they vacationed in outer space? Well, in some sense, yes. There's very little new scientific value coming out of space tourism because we know we can do it. It's just an engineering problem to make it convenient, to make it suitable for the average person. So there's no new science involved. However, let's be honest, they're paying for it. In other words, the taxpayers are not using their taxpayers' money in order to fund billionaires to have a plaything in outer space. So if billionaires want to spend $250,000 for a short ride into outer space, I say, well, why not? And just remember that it is probably inevitable that this will become commonplace. The richest man on Earth, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, he has created his own spaceport in Texas. He doesn't have to go to Cape Canaveral. He has his own spaceport in Texas, and he is testing his rocket, the new Shepard rocket, which has undergone successful testing And it is not a space plane. The Spaceship Two being pushed by Richard Branson is a space plane. That is, it looks like an airplane, but it has a rocket engine, and it piggybacks on a larger vehicle and then reaches the boundary between the Earth and outer space. Jeff Bezos has a slightly different scenario. New Shepard is a real rocket. If you look at it, you say, no, 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 it's not a space plane. It is a real rocket. And it is a reusable rocket. It's a rocket that can take off, go to the very boundaries of outer space, and then rocket back to Earth and then land on its launching pad. And so it is a reusable rocket, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com has already tested it, and he wants to make sure that his New Shepard rocket will take tourists into outer space. But he's not content just to go to the boundary of the Earth and outer space. Alan Shepard, of course, was the first American to be sent into outer space. He went up and came back down again. That's why Jeff Bezos' rocket is called New Shepard. It goes up and it comes back down again. However, now Jeff Bezos is pushing the New Glenn rocket. John Glenn, of course, was the astronaut who went completely around the planet Earth. And that's what this next line of rockets is all about. New Glenn is a rocket that will orbit the planet Earth, also being tested, we think, by Jeff Bezos in Texas, not to mention that he has yet another rocket, a third rocket called the New Armstrong rocket. Now, you can imagine what the New Armstrong rocket is. It's a moon rocket. And by the way, we now have not one, not two, but three possible moon rockets. Just remember that after 50 years, we have not sent a moon rocket into outer space until now. Just a few months ago, Elon Musk of SpaceX sent the Falcon Heavy rocket blasting off from Cape Canaveral on a historic mission. It was the first time in 50 years that a moon rocket sailed off from Cape Canaveral in a test and realized that that rocket was paid for not by the taxpayers, but by a private individual. This is amazing. Prices have gone down so far that billionaires, as a pet project, can fund their own moon rocket, in this case, the Falcon Heavy, which had a successful launch just a few months ago. And now NASA, not to be outdone, is using taxpayers' money to launch the SLS booster rocket starting next year. If all goes well, in December of 2019, NASA will launch the first mission to the moon in 50 years in an unmanned mission which will orbit around the moon. And then a few years later, it will launch another SLS booster rocket, this time containing astronauts. So after 50 years, we are going back to the moon. And then, as I said, we also have a dark horse. We also have Jeff Bezos, who is pushing the New Armstrong rocket, which in principle can also go to the moon. So what I'm trying to tell you is something very simple. We could have a traffic jam around the moon. Not one, not two, but three separate moon rockets. The SLS, pushed by NASA, costing about $1 billion per launch, and paid for by you and me. Then we have Elon Musk of SpaceX, who is funding his moon rocket with his own pocket money. And then we have the richest man in the world, not to be outdone, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who has his version of a moon rocket. So we have not one, not two, but three different moon rockets. And not to be outdone, Elon Musk has yet another rocket, and that is the BLF, capable of taking astronauts all the way to Mars. Who would have thought? Think about that, a private individual spearheading a rocket, the BFR, that can take astronauts all the way to the red planet. And what does BFR stand for? Well, B stands for big, R stands for rocket, and F stands for, well, your imagination. Well, we're heating up. Because Silicon Valley billionaires are putting their vision on the line, we're seeing a new round of space exploration. You see, Elon Musk wants to create a multi-planet species. In other words, Earthlings should not just be on one planet, but on several planets. That's his vision. And Jeff Bezos has yet another vision, and that vision is to create the Earth as a celestial park. The Earth should be like the Garden of Eden. All heavy polluting industries would be put into outer space. So pollution would be dispersed in outer space, leaving the Earth as a celestial park, a gleaming, green, safe, and clean park in the heavens. And speaking about space, we also have to talk about war. Vladimir Putin, just a few months ago in March, unveiled a new rocket, a new vehicle that could ignite a new space race. It is called the Hypersonic Glide Vehicle. And Vladimir Putin announced in March that, yes, they have tested the Hypersonic Glide Vehicle. Yes, it will nullify America's Star Wars program, and it is a new weapon that has to be put on the table. Well, United States rocket officials have been scratching their heads, wondering, what is the Hypersonic Glide Vehicle? Well, it turns out that the United States is also working on hypersonic glide vehicles. It tested one just a few years ago. The test was unsuccessful. But the Russians are now crowing about the fact that their hypersonic glide vehicle is successful and can neutralize America's Star Wars program. So what is this new rocket? First of all, it's not a rocket at all. It's a vehicle that rides on top of an ICBM. And usually the ICBM, when it hits the top of its trajectory, releases the reentry vehicles containing the hydrogen warheads, which then glide at hypersonic velocities and hit their target. That's called a nuclear warfighting vehicle. However, a hypersonic glide vehicle is different. And that is, it's almost like an airplane. It also separates from the ICBM, but it can glide, it can maneuver at Mach 20, 20 times the speed of sound, which is roughly 700 miles per hour. In that sense, it could then outmaneuver an anti-ballistic missile system, a Star Wars system, and that's why Vladimir Putin is crowing about the fact that he has perfected a hypersonic glide vehicle. Well, is this a game changer? Well, when it comes to nuclear warfighting, the answer is yes. But is it that dangerous? Probably no. And the reason is the United States and China are also experimenting with hypersonic glide vehicles, and they are very difficult to control. You are traveling at 10 to 20 times the speed of sound. Normally, a reentry vehicle simply glides and doesn't maneuver, but when you maneuver a craft at these velocities, all hell can break loose, the vehicle can spin out of control, and many analysts simply say it's not worth the risk to put so much money in a hypersonic glide vehicle. Also, news from the medical front. Doctors in the United States are alarmed by the fact that the incidence of colon cancer is rising. Colon cancer is the second leading killer of cancer in the United States. So it recommends now that people as young as 45 years of age should begin testing for colon cancer. Now, if you ask the average male, for example, why didn't you get tested for colon cancer? They'll say the obvious. You mean have that thing stuck up your ear? Well, yes. A colonoscopy does mean having a rod stuck up your ear that then photographs polyps that are growing inside your colon, some of which could be precancerous. And get this, right on the spot, this device can clip the polyp and remove that danger all in one stroke. And you don't even feel it. You are under a mild anesthetic. You don't even feel the fact that you have this tube going up your ear and clipping polyps to make sure that you don't come down with colon cancer. In other words, it's definitely worth the risk. And also the brain is in the news today. Scientists in King's College, England, have announced the fact that they have a new insight into autism. Autism, of course, which is a horrible affliction of the young growing brain. Many children with autism simply cannot lock onto human behavior. Many of them never learn to talk. They don't make eye contact with you in some cases. And mild forms of autism can actually lead to people becoming autistic geniuses. Well, it turns out these scientists believe now that there are two kinds of cells, go and no-go cells. And they say that the imbalance between them could create autism. Well, this is the first of a series of studies. We'll have to follow it. Go cells initiate activity of the brain. No-go cells inhibit that activity, and the ratio between them is disturbed in the young, growing autistic brain. What these scientists did was they first looked at the animal kingdom and their brains, and they found that, yes, in animals there are two kinds of cells in the brain. The first are the go cells, which initiate behavior. One go cell fires and sets off a cascade, and that initiates an action. However, there are also the no-go cells, which inhibit. And so there's a relationship between setting off a cascade of neural activity and also checking it and making sure that it's done correctly. And so in other words, the human brain is just not one form of activity of go. It's a delicate dance between go and no-go. And what these scientists found is that throughout the animal kingdom, the ratio between go and no-go cells are more or less the same. However, they also found out that in animals with brain defects, with problems with behavior that seem to mimic autism, there's an imbalance. There are too many no-go cells and not enough go cells. And this happens during infancy. So in infancy, when the brain cells are being formed, the ratio between these two cells is set. And in animals, which seem to mimic certain forms of behavior similar to autism, there's an imbalance. And so then the authors speculate, and this is, of course, speculation, that this could be one of the origins of autism in human beings. That when the brain grows in children, there's an imbalance between these two kinds of cells, and so the ratio between action and inaction is disturbed, and that could cause autism. Well, it's just a theory. And we'll have to keep track of how this theory develops with time. Well, unfortunately, that's it for the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion about a potential war in outer space, as mentioned by Vladimir Putin in his March press conference. And we're going to bring on a special guest, Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst, who'll talk about the latest concerning what we do know and don't know about warfare in outer space. And so once again, we're going to talk about war in outer space. A war fought with satellites, with laser beams, with kinetic energy weapons, and perhaps with hypervelocity, hypersonic glide weapons. And so we'll talk about all these new developments in Star Wars technology when we bring on our special guest in the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In this part of Exploration, we're going to bring on a weapons analyst, Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, Michael Moore, the weapons analyst, talking about Star Wars and war in outer space. As we mentioned earlier, in March, Vladimir Putin announced a new weapon the hypersonic glide vehicle, a weapon that can travel at Mach 10 or Mach 20 up to 20 times the speed of sound. It rides on an ICBM and can go right through any Star Wars shield, at least that's the claim made by the Russians. And the question is, are we entering a new phase in the arms race? That is, war in outer space. Now, of course, at the present time, the great superpowers of the world are not shooting down each other's satellites. We're not talking about nuclear war taking place anytime soon. But the question is, are we entering a new phase of the arms race when we're putting weapons in outer space? What will a space war look like? And that's what we're going to talk about with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, who has studied the whole question. Are we entering a new phase of the arms race? Not between two superpowers fielding ICBMs, but warfare in outer space. When we attack each other's satellites, when we try to penetrate Star Wars shields, that's what we're going to ask today with Michael Moore, the weapons analyst. Now I'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. You know, the United States hit the moon just the other day. We bombed the moon. Does it have military value? Well, not really. However, there's a larger question, and that is in the future. In the future, nations will see space as a military asset. We saw that during the Gulf War crises. And then the question is, what secret steps are nations making right now, even as we speak, to prepare for a possible war in outer space? A war that could wipe out satellites. It could cause a tremendous collapse of the industrial infrastructure as power lines go out, communications go blank, the internet is stopped. It could cause all sorts of havoc if we have a war in outer space. So with us once again is Michael Moore. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in peace and disarmament issues?
I've been interested in peace and disarmament issues all my adult life, and certainly after we had children, it became a more personal thing to me. I've always thought nuclear weapons were clearly immoral, and that goes back to the 1950s.
And tell us about your involvement with the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Well, I became editor in 1991 and retired in 2000, and that was the end of the Cold War. Our circulation was slipping, and I told the board at my first board meeting we should be overjoyed that our circulation was slipping because that meant the nuclear threat was waning. But I got involved because I wanted to do whatever I could to ensure that nuclear weapons were never again used.
Okay. Now, most Americans don't know that there is a very fierce competition to dominate outer space. They heard about the Chinese test that took place several months ago, and many analysts were outraged that thousands of pieces of debris are now in orbit around the Earth as a consequence of the Chinese test. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Chinese test.
Well, it was a test in January of last year, and they smashed an alien weather satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, with a so-called kinetic kill weapon, which means they just ran into it, smashed it into many, many thousands of pieces. It replicated a test in a rough kind of way that we conducted in 1985. The Chinese test is interesting because the Chinese have wanted us to, us meaning the United States and the rest of the world, to negotiate a new outer space treaty that would prevent any kind of conflict in space and weapons in space and space-related weapons on the ground and so on. And we have dismissed that. Every time the Chinese have brought it up, we have dismissed the idea. And I regard it as a shot across the bow. The Chinese were saying, if you intend to dominate space, we're going to challenge you. But we would rather, the Chinese would rather, negotiate a treaty.
Okay. Now let's say a few things about the past, because most people were caught flat-footed when the Chinese test took place, not realizing that there's a long history of this going all the way back to the beginning of the space age. So isn't it true that even with the launching of Sputnik back in 57, there were voices talking about a potential war in outer space?
Oh, absolutely. And President Eisenhower anticipated this kind of thing as early as 1955 and established a space for peaceful purposes policy for the United States, because he did not want to see the Cold War extended into space. He thought that would be very dangerous. Then after Sputnik, a lot of people criticized Eisenhower for being flat-footed on this issue. Actually, he wasn't. But he was widely criticized. Even his own chief of staff of the Air Force, Thomas Dresser White, argued publicly in February of 1958 that control of space should be the goal of all Americans. But Eisenhower resisted that idea. He did not want to be the first president to militarize space. He did not want to see the Cold War go into space. And that policy was followed by Kennedy and Johnson and eventually became the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, an international treaty that is still in force.
But isn't it true that even during that period of time, the United States was in fact building killer satellite systems and in fact had an operational system based in the Pacific with Thor missiles that actually detonated hydrogen bombs in outer space?
It's true that the United States researched systems, and the Soviet Union was very aggressive when it came to space. The Soviet Union, until the Outer Space Treaty, was testing various systems. The Soviet Union was even talking about putting hydrogen bombs in space or in suborbital space. There were two different systems they were talking about, and the United States was reactive in that respect. We did have a Thor system with a hydrogen bomb warhead that was to be used as an anti-satellite system. But it was a very limited system. We could launch two Thors, which wouldn't have made any real difference. And then the system was activated, but in a very clumsy kind of way. It was clear to everybody that we didn't want to use it. Nobody really wanted to use it. Then later on, we did test nuclear weapons in space, and one, the so-called Starfish Prime test, knocked out electrical service in parts of Hawaii, and it killed a few satellites of other nations, and we realized that exploding nuclear weapons in space was not a good idea.
And isn't it true that Robert McNamara began to be a little bit skeptical about shooting hydrogen bombs in outer space because it would create an electromagnetic pulse? In fact, wasn't this the first time we've ever seen an electromagnetic pulse in action that could wipe out our own communication systems?
You're absolutely right. The electromagnetic pulse was perceived as very dangerous to our systems and to other kinds of systems, military and civilian.
And didn't Robert McNamara actually go ahead and try to deploy a anti-ballistic missile system called the Sprint, which never became fully operational and wasted billions of dollars?
He did. He was very skeptical of it. He was pushed into it by hardliners on the right, and it was viewed as a Chinese, anti-Chinese system. It was pretty well understood by then that we could not defeat a Soviet attack, but we believed that the Chinese would someday have missiles, and then the system would at least defeat a small Chinese attack. But it was only operational for a few months, and billions of dollars were spent. It was not popular with anybody except the aerospace industry and certain senators and congressmen.
Okay, so we went through the 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, President Ronald Reagan changes the whole landscape by talking about Star Wars, and people were talking about Buck Rogers-type laser particle beam accelerators in outer space, zapping things from outer space. What happened to the original Buck Rogers schemes?
Well, Ronald Reagan's Star Wars scheme was kind of fantastical. He was sold on it by Edward Teller and some other people, and it was viewed as an anti-ballistic missile system, and we would have anti-ballistic missile systems in space. We would have battle stars in space and so on and so forth. It was a kind of a crazy thing. I have to say Ronald Reagan was far-reaching in one way. He believed that the mad system of mutual destruction was literally mad. He wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he believed that the Star Wars system would do that. Meanwhile, there were people on his staff and in his administration who viewed it as a way of advancing space control. If we had anti-ballistic missile systems, we could also have anti-satellite systems, and we could control space. But it just wasn't technically possible then. It may be technically possible now to hit satellites from space. It still isn't possible to hit ballistic missiles, in my opinion.
Now, if you do, in fact, have a Star Wars shield, isn't that also a potential first strike weapon? President Richard Nixon used this analogy. Nixon said, if you have two gladiators, the first gladiator strikes first, disarming most of the enemy's ability, and then you have a shield to absorb a weakened second strike from the second gladiator. So in some sense, this system is not only a defensive system, it's also an offensive first strike system, right?
You're right about that. Almost any defensive system of that kind can be viewed as part of a first strike system. And that's very dangerous. It's unstable. And that's why a lot of military people actually oppose these kinds of systems because of the dangers of being viewed as a first strike system. The people who push it most ardently tend to be civilians, people who have never been in war, don't understand war, and who have hardline ideologies.
Okay, so in the 80s came the big disappointment that Ronald Reagan's great schemes violated the known laws of physics and the known laws of technology. However, in the 90s, isn't it true that the United States kept on going with a limited off-the-shelf Star Wars system, shooting a bullet with another bullet over the Pacific?
It's true that in the 90s we continued these systems, but mainly after the fall of the Soviet Union, a new paradigm emerged, which had the support of a lot of military people as well as hardline civilian people. It went like this. The Cold War had been very dangerous to both the United States and the Soviet Union. We should not permit another existential threat to the United States. Therefore, the way to do that was to be overwhelmingly militarily dominant on land, at sea, in the air, and in space. And I'm very concerned about the space end of that because the idea that space should be reserved for peaceful purposes as part of international law. But during the 90s, great progress was made in developing the doctrine for space control and even the hardware to exercise space control.
Okay, now take us to the present. Take us to the present in the sense of what are the capabilities of the United States, Russia, and China vis-a-vis space weapons? What's the state of the art today?
Well, the state of the art is this. The United States is many, 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 many years ahead of China and the United and Russia in terms of being able to control space with anti-satellite weapons. We are working on several techniques. The most important, really, is small robotic satellites that can be launched into space and seek and find and rendezvous with any satellite we want them to. And, of course, if you can rendezvous with another satellite, then you can do damaging things to it. We call these robotic satellites peaceful in that they could service future American satellites. But you can call that peaceful if you want. But if you can come up to another satellite and service it, you can also destroy it or damage it.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Michael Moore, author of the book Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And if you get the Science Channel, watch for a 12-episode series that I'll be hosting based on my best-selling book, Physics of the Impossible. 12 episodes that I'll be hosting for the Science Channel. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Michael Moore, a weapons analyst, author of a rather disturbing book called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. Well, maybe you're one of the people that woke up early in the morning to watch us bomb the moon. Well, people ask the question, was there a military application to such technology? Well, the answer is yes, but rather minimal. It doesn't really take that much to bomb the moon. We can reach the moon in 3 days, which is probably too long if you're going to be fighting a nuclear war on the planet Earth. However, there really is a Twilight War going on, not with regards to bombing the moon, but secret classified studies being done on space warfare, satellite warfare, killer satellite warfare, ASAT warfare. And with us today to discuss this is Michael Moore, the weapons analyst. The book is called Twilight War, The Folly of U.S. Space Dominance. And where we last left off, we were talking about space weapons, and even lasers can be used in outer space to destroy or blind enemy satellites.
We're very far along in these programs. We're also working on a ground-based laser system that could damage or possibly even destroy satellites of other nations in space.
And in fact, wasn't there a Star Wars test, maybe 10 years ago, where the space shuttle was supposed to intercept a laser beam from the planet Earth? However, they misread inches and meters. And as a consequence of that, the media picked up on it. Because we misread meters and inches, the space shuttle oriented itself toward outer space rather than toward the Earth. And as a consequence, the Star Wars test failed. But isn't it true, therefore, that we are using the space shuttle to test space weapons in the sense that we shoot lasers, very low-power lasers, at the space shuttle?
Well, I wouldn't call those weapons tests. We are researching lasers, and in fact, we illuminated a satellite in 1997 with a low-power laser. But we are working on the technology. But the main thing we're working on are these robotic small satellites, because they have the potential for doing almost anything we want to in space. They have the potential for hitting targets in low Earth orbit, which are just a few hundred miles above the Earth, or in higher orbits, many thousands of miles above the Earth. That's where the big threat is right now, and other countries understand this. They're very keen on developing a treaty that would stop the development of such weapons.
Now, isn't it true that smaller nations like India, being outgunned and being overwhelmed by U.S. technology, have issued some dark threats that they may launch what is called a keg of nails? A keg of nails would be a barrel of nails with gunpowder inside, very low tech. You simply detonate it in outer space, and since most satellites are European and U.S. satellites, these nails then basically wipe out a good chunk of U.S. systems.
Well,
so that's
one of the ultimate nightmares in the space business. It's very easy to destroy a satellite, any kind of satellite of any size, by putting debris, pellets, gravel, nails, whatever, in the orbital path. And then that idea has been around for at least 40 years. And it's terrible. It's a terrible thing. If you do that, and if you do several of those, you could drain the space almost forever.
Now, the question is, who would suffer the most if there is a showdown in outer space? The Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. Now that the United States is reaching for superiority in outer space, the question is, will it drop it on its own feet? So who would suffer the most if war breaks out in space?
Well, you're getting to the heart of an important issue, a dispute between a lot of high-level military people, mainly in the Air Force, and civilian hardliners. High-level military people in the Air Force tend to argue we have the most to lose, meaning the United States. About 850 active satellites are in orbit, and about half of those, a little bit more than half, are American. So if we ever had a conflict in space, we would stand the risk of losing many, many, many of our own satellites. So the argument, and I've heard this from colonels and generals, the argument is, why are we being so belligerent in our space policy? Why are we using rhetoric and developing hardware that might start another arms race? Because if the arms race ever turns into a conflict, we do have a lot to lose.
Now, if you have two gunfighters about to shoot it out at OK Corral, and one gunfighter grabs sand and throws sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding the enemy, that's like space war, in which case the blinded gunfighter then shoots randomly in all directions. So if it does come to space war, not only do we have all the space debris in outer space, but won't the blinded enemies basically fire randomly and create even more havoc?
Well, that's another important argument. War games have borne this out, that if we play a war game, and if we, as you put it, blind the other side by damaging their satellite, there's going to be retaliation. It's going to be much more random than it would have been otherwise. It's a very dangerous business to take out the other nation's satellite. And I have to emphasize that a lot of military people are really against this aggressive space policy we're talking about. There's a real split here between hardliners, neoconservatives, triumphalists on the one side, and fairly sober military people on the other side.
Now, Vladimir Putin has basically gone ballistic over the Star Wars anti-missile system being based in Eastern Europe, even though the United States has tried to reassure it that it's basically to be used against Iran and, quote, rogue nations. The Russians are fuming that it's basically in their sphere of influence. So tell us what's happening now in Europe.
Well, you know, we are talking about having two facilities in Europe, and the Russians are very unhappy about that, because it would be a little bit like the Russians putting a couple of systems into Canada. I mean, it's right on their doorstep, as Canada is on ours. And if you put facilities on their doorstep, who's to say that 10 years from now that we won't use them in other ways as coercive tools against Moscow? It's a very ambiguous situation. Countries or national leaders look at the intentions of other countries, but they mainly look at capabilities. Intentions can change, but capabilities do not change so easily. And if one country has a lot of power in one area, they may say, we will not use it now, but 10 years from now, the intentions may change, and the Russians are very conscious of that.
And Putin even raised the stakes last year when he put his weapons basically on alert status and threatened Europe with nuclear retaliation. So this is really upping the stakes, right? And while in the United States there's almost no publicity around this, the Russians are fuming.
Well, they're fuming, but this alert business is rhetorical. Both countries, both the United States and Russia, have weapons on alert, and they say they're detargeted, but it's just a matter of, it would take a matter of minutes to retarget them. It's done for rhetorical effect. It's not a strategic change, in my opinion.
Now let's talk about China. If you read the Chinese concerns, first of all, they believe that a Star Wars system would decouple Taiwan away from mainland China. And China has said, more or less, that there's only one scenario in which they would unleash the power of their military, and that is over Taiwan. So isn't the United States touching very sensitive areas when there is a possible decoupling of Taiwan from China, in which case China has already stated that it will go to war?
Well, the Chinese-Taiwan situation, I think, has been handled very clumsily in this country. You're quite right. The Chinese will not tolerate a true independence move by Taiwan. On the other hand, the Taiwanese tend to act very independently in many areas, and we have sold them weapons for years and years and years. It's always a tense situation. And the space assets used for military purposes have accentuated this. One of the favorite war games being played in the military over here is, what if the Chinese launch a surprise attack against satellites, which are, in effect, surveilling China and Taiwan? What if they blind us? What do we do then? And this is kind of a silly scenario. The Chinese have no interest in taking on the United States militarily. They make goods for the United States. They make goods for the Western world, and they need those jobs. Meanwhile, we need the Chinese. The Chinese are buying roughly $200 billion worth of treasury notes and bonds every year. That keeps our interest rates low. We're in bed together financially, economically, so why would there be a military challenge from China? Why can't we cooperate? We're in a new century. I think the old Cold War paradigms don't work anymore.
And that concludes our interview with Michael Moore, not the filmmaker, but the weapons analyst. And we're talking about perhaps a new way in which nuclear war will be waged, a war fought in outer space, a war fought with satellites, a war fought with perhaps advanced weapons like hypersonic glide weapons that Vladimir Putin boasted about back in March. So let's hope that this new arms race doesn't get out of control. And once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.